Hello, this is Mike Swanson. I'm the author of the book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In a few moments, another episode of The Great Parallax Views will begin. But before it starts, let me tell you about my book. It's available at Amazon.com, The War State. It's about how the United States became a global superpower after World War II and has brought us to this situation. Grab the book at Amazon.com after the show.
I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. The podcast series you are about to hear befell listeners of a program known as Parallax Views, hosted and produced by J.G. Michael, who the recently arrested John McAfee once speculated was an extraterrestrial Gorgon, devised a series of episodes to be produced and published over the course of a two-week period leading up to Halloween 2020. The result of those recordings led to one of the most bizarre auditory experiences in podcasting history, the Halloween Podcast Massacre. That's right, listeners. It's the Parallax Views Halloween Podcast Massacre, where we celebrate the spooky season with a variety of guests that'll delve into the macabre and ghoulish with us. First up, filmmaker Jeff Norvisgaard and cinematographer James Suttles on their brand new, extremely fun thrill ride of a movie, The Good Things Devils Do, a vampire romp now available on Amazon streaming, starring such horror movie heavyweights as Emmy and Lon Chaney award-winning actor Bill Oberst, Scream Queen Linnea Quigley, and Jason Voorhees himself, Kane Hodder. If you have yet to see it, well, The Good Things Devils Do may just become annual Halloween viewing and a cult classic in the near future. So buckle up as we begin the Halloween Podcast Massacre with Jess Norvisgaard and James Suttles on their new movie, The Good Things Devils Do. Welcome to Parallax Views for the first episode of our Halloween series for 2020. Filmmaker Jess Norvisgaard and James Suttles, who are behind the wild ride of a new film, The Vampire Romp, The Good Things Devils Do, now available on streaming. How are you guys doing today?
Doing pretty good, man.
Doing great, man.
Yep. How about you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. I was actually really impressed by this little movie you guys put together. There's been quite a few movies vying each and every year now. I think ever since Michael Dougherty's Trick or Treat came out, the horror anthology, there's been a few movies every year that sort of try to be the new annual Halloween viewing. There was James Rodet's Gravy a few years back, Tales of Halloween. There's tons and tons of them, but this one really took me by surprise. How did it all come together? Do you want to maybe start with a synopsis for my listeners that are unfamiliar?
Sure. You want me to take this, James, and I'll pass it to you?
Yeah, man. You talk story, man.
Okay. It all came together. I had fashioned this out to be a short film a long time ago, many, many, many years ago. I had decided it was time to do a feature. James is a wonderful producer. He's a cinematographer, and he's a director. So I walked up to him. I said, "Hey, buddy," I said, "I want you to produce this film." And he said, "Which one is it going to be?" It came down to five films. Halloween is my favorite holiday. I love the different tropes, whether it be werewolves, vampires, zombies, ghosts, ghouls, witches. We decided, keep a long story short, we decided to go with this vampire movie. The reason why we thought it was fun. It was a good rookie project. I'm a rookie feature film director. I'd asked James, I said, "I want you to guide me through this process, man. And I want you to produce it for me. I want you to shoot it for me." James is somebody who really does believe in seeing the director's vision. I thought it was a good fit. I really wanted to pay homage to some of my favorite films, Return of the Living Dead, Night of the Demons, Creepshow. I said, "James, I think you're going to love shooting this. I think you're going to love the lighting setups and then some of the different things we have. And let's do it." So we just decided to do it, man. We jumped in.
Yeah, I mean, I come into things with very analytical approach to doing independent film at this scale. And one of the biggest issues that we had was the scale of the film. How do we make this, the story that Jess had written on the budget that we had? Because we didn't have a lot of money. I mean, that's sort of the nature of independent horror films now, right? And sort of that analytical approach is like, you got to have one location, you got to have a small cast. So like looking at it from a business decision, this seemed like it was the right script to do because it was that one location house. We had a very finite amount of cast that we needed. It was a little ambitious on the effects side. It was a little ambitious on, ultimately became very ambitious on the cast side. But with my producer hat on, this was the right story to choose out of the five that Jess sort of brought to the table there at first. Simply because of just the analytical reasons of producing a low-budget independent film.
James, if you could you tell my listeners a little bit about your prior experiences with film?
Yeah, I've been a filmmaker for 20 years now. 20 years now since I was a young 19-year-old, I guess. But I started a production company when I was 19, doing commercial production, that sort of thing for clients. And then about 5 years later, I decided I was going to go full on DP cinematographer track. And I gave up the client work and gave up that company and started producing or working on films in the faith-based area and the sports genres, and then ultimately doing a lot of horror films. And about 7 years ago, I decided that I was tired of working for other people doing feature work. And so I started producing my own stuff. As Jess said, I've directed a number of films at this point. I've got a business model that I've developed on producing this scale of film because I truly do see independent film, whether it's horror, whether it's another genre, this is the new business model that it is these budgets. And so I really have tried to develop a business model that makes this achievable in producing these type of films. And I think that's where Jess and I came together. He wanted to do his first film. And this is the model that it takes to do it. And I think that we did something really special. And I think we actually did a lot more with the money. We stretched our pennies very far with this film. I mean, especially when you look at the cast and when you look at the production value, I think we did a pretty fantastic job, if I do say so myself.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wanted to ask about the budget. If I could, I know some directors are like, "I don't want to mention how much we spent on the film," but I look at the Blumhouse movies, like Halloween and Black Christmas, and those all have been made by Blumhouse in the past few years, theater releases. Those are only made usually on a couple million dollars. So this is even smaller scale than that. Are you open to talking about the budget a little bit, Jess?
Absolutely. We're in the ballpark of $100,000.
Wow.
Yeah, that's why I approached James. James has a model that he shoots. So I had walked over. The scalability for this was over that. And he was, I credit him because he asked me, "When you come in this office, bring me the model that I'm asking you to bring me. Don't go over." Well, what did I do? I went over. We decided we're going to do this, and we did it. But yeah, that's about where we were, man.
Yeah, we're producing these at this one and a number of other ones that have been done the past couple of years at 10%, 5% of what Blumhouse is doing. And And again, I mean, it goes back to this where I think the business is going, for better or for worse. But part of that is, I think the reason Jess initially approached me is that part of the way that I keep those budgets down is I own my own grip and camera rental house. So the equipment comes, you know, part of the package. I have my own post facilities. I have my own studio. So we sort of have this whole built-in ecosystem to be able to produce these things. So those are things you can cut off the bottom line, right? And we don't bill it back to the production. It's just part of my company's contribution. But yeah, Jess did walk in, as he said. He was a bit ambitious with his script, and we tailored it, pulled it back, and we made it work. And then we started having a wish list of the cast, and that started increasing the budget. So it's all like this push and pull, right? We cut concepts and ideas out of the script initially to make it fit the budget, and then we spend a little bit more money on the cast, and we got to figure out ways to save here and there. That's part of filmmaking in general, I think.
And that was my promise to him, JG, as a director. When I said, listen, I'm going to utilize your skills, and what I'm going to bring to the table is, we're going to have a film that is going to surpass what most people do. We're going to do with $100,000 what most people can't do with $1 million. And that's flaws and warts and all. I feel like we've done that. But what I'm going to do is what I'm going to bring to the table is with my direction, the vision, and what we have is, we're going to make a film that is going to be enjoyable, that's going to be an audience pleaser for our demographic, for horror fans, I think, you know, and I think a lot of people who aren't horror fans are going to love it. It's fun. But what we're going to do is, we're going to make this fun. What I wanted to avoid, and James and I had a big, long meeting about this before we ever began, we're going to avoid the day player plague. You know, we're going to bring in one person and put them on the cover for a day. We're going to avoid that. We're going to bring these people in. We're going to be demanding of great actors and pros and seasoned vets and the other people we have coming in. We're going to make a fun story. It's going to be one of the reasons why we chose Devils. It is a fun ride. It is just meant, again, for my rookie campaign and joining forces with Subtle Film, is we're going to have something that the audience can sit back. They can have a great time. It's a popcorn film. It's a horror film. It's a Halloween film. It's an any day of the week film, any month. But you're going to have a damn good time. We're not going to bore you. We're not going to bullshit you. We're going to have a great time. And these actors are here playing roles. And things are going to be at stake.
So I want to delve deeper into the movie itself, but I wanted to ask you something, James. You mentioned the sort of model for movies changing. I feel that we're in this interesting place. I was looking over some of the big horror films that are going to be in theaters in 2021, permitting the pandemic situation doesn't mess up things even more than it has already. But I noticed almost all the films coming out in theaters are franchises. Oh, a new Chucky film, a new Texas Chainsaw, two new Halloween movies. It seems like the most interesting films now are coming out on streaming services, the ones that aren't just a retread of a franchise.
And that's exactly it. Look, I think Hollywood and your studios are being ran by accountants, right? And so if an accountant's running the numbers and they see that a Halloween franchise is guaranteed a certain audience that already has awareness of it, they're going to go into the theater and see it. You know, and now, I mean, it's costing, you know, $15-$20 plus to go to a theater. So people, you know, viewers are not, they're not willing to just go spend the weekend or spend the evening, I should say, on a whim's notice to go see a film. Now it becomes an event. It's almost like going to a theater performance, going to a theme park, right? The price is getting there. I mean, I have four kids, right? I got a family of six. I go to the movie theater, I'm going to spend $100-$120, and that's, you know, being cheap. So I think there's some economics at play, right? And so the audience is limiting themselves to how many films are seeing in theaters. The accountants that are running the studios are wanting guaranteed hits. And so the uniqueness of what cinema used to be, and whether it's in horror, I mean, horror has always been full of unique ideas and concepts, but all genres are to a certain extent in the indie scene now. And if you look at the 70s and 80s, there were a lot better films coming out, in my opinion, because people were taking risks and not telling the same story, right? Why do we need another Halloween movie? Geez, we've seen the damn same story over and over. It's a retread. I mean, yeah, we got a couple of interesting filmmakers that are behind the new ones, but it's the same story, right? And so everything's becoming, I think, film in general is becoming plagued with retreads, right?
Retreads and remakes.
Yeah. And so that's where, you know, like Jess said, the movies that I've done, this movie that he and I did together, you know, it's got warts, it's got holes, it's got, you know, it's got things that he and I have talked about that we wish we could go back and we could fix. We see where the problems are with it. But damn, man, you know, we made it for, you know, for pennies, and we told a story that is unique. It's different. It's not a remake of something. There are films that are similar. Sure, there are the vampire films, but there's not one that's been told in the same way. And that's ultimately the goal of what I'm trying to do. And I think what Jess and I have talked about doing in the future with other projects, you know, it's about taking the risk. And if we're not spending that much money, we have the ability to take risks that clearly the accountants of Hollywood aren't willing to do anymore. And so that's my motivating factor in all of this.
Yeah. Yeah. Mine too. And to piggyback off of that, I think in theaters a lot too is, you know, these producers are trying to look for a guaranteed bottom line. They're making sure they don't lose money. And these are safe bets. For instance, today I hear that they're remaking Nicole Kidman's The Others, and I'm tired of it. But right now, like you said, yeah, I think some of the riskier movies, some of the more ambitious movies are coming out on their streamers. And so, hey, if that's where it's going, that's where it's going. Let's rock and roll.
I feel like in some ways we're getting I may be wrong about this, but I feel like we've gotten a little bit of a new golden age of horror movies, but they're all on the streaming, the newer horror movies that are not just franchises. And I'm really excited about that. And I'm really excited about what you were able to accomplish with The Good Things Devils Do. If I could, I want to read the synopsis really quick for my listeners. And this is your synopsis off IMDb, Jess. Yeah. Richard, a small-time gangster, is retiring. Before he can, he must take one last job to steal money from a rival gangster's house. Miles apart, Melvin is a reluctant family man who has dreams of becoming a famous curator for his Museum of the Macabre. His newest acquisition? The remains of the notorious Masquerade, a vampire born from the embers of hell, slain centuries ago. On Halloween night, their paths will collide, and they will be forced to work together to fight centuries-old evil with everything on the line. That sounds like a very fun time. And I want to know, where did the idea come from to sort of meld, you know, almost Reservoir Dogs with the vampire genre?
To be frank with you, man, years ago when I was putting this short together, it was a project for my buddies, a project for some actor buddies. And so I literally just put, you know, square pegs and square holes and was slotting people in that I thought could work. It became something that I liked. And of course the feature film idea was a little different than the short film, but that's where it originated from. And one thing I did like, some will say we executed it well, some may disagree, and that's fine. But I love the idea of this kind of cartoony world where it's, you know, we have some horror movies, particularly back in the 80s, you know, they would have these kind of funny characters. And I liked introducing them into two worlds kind of crossing together. Richard, you know, played by Bill Oberst Jr. and in his group with Kane Hodder, Percy with him, these really bad people, or certainly criminals, intersecting with this kind of Leave It to Beaver family, as flawed as they were, you know? And so we melded the two soundtracks together. We melded the two storylines together, and it just kind of exploded. And Masquerade was basically the arbiter, basically coming out and saying, you know, hell with both of you. I'm gonna put a monkey wrench in both your plans. And I think narratively it was a little ambitious. I'd like to have some things back. But one thing I am pleased with is that it was fun. It accomplished the goals for the most part. And it was just a lot of fun intersecting those two elements together. And so I think that's what we were aiming for.
James, what were your thoughts on the script, the screenplay? What did you make of it? What sort of drew you to it?
So, you know, like we said before, there was four or five different stories that Jess was pitching and mulling around. For me, it was it was actually really kind of a simple thing. It was the fact that it was set Halloween. I loved the concept of the cast of characters in costume. So the visual elements of that was really attractive to me. The fact it's set at Halloween, which then ties back to your point very early on, which is, we want to try to create a film that was a film that people could watch every year, you know, in October. So that was another sort of a business marketing concept. Well, maybe we create something that's identified with the season. But for me, it's strange. Story is incredibly important, but for me, a lot of times it's how can I visualize the movie and does the movie feel like it's going to look exciting? And I think that comes from, from the years that I've worked as a cinematographer. I'm a visual person first and foremost. And then out of that, in a situation like this where Jess is directing and writing, I'm going to make sure that I rely on him to deliver on his end when it comes to story and character development. But it was the pitch, it's the idea, it's the visuals that all drew me to it to begin with.
I wanted to talk about the visuals. One thing I said to Jess when I first contacted him was that, I see a lot of these movies that try to go either for a retro sort of grindhouse feel, based off of, that Tarantino movie, the Tarantino Rodriguez movie, Grindhouse. And then I also see people trying to ape this sort of Dario Argento, like red filters, Keller in their films. This is very distinct in that it has a lot of blue and purple sort of filters and lighting. Where did that materialize from?
When Jess and I started talking about the film, and I don't remember exactly at what point, Jess, it was, but we started really identifying with the films of the 70s and Creepshow. You mentioned Creepshow early on. And it wasn't as much the Argento reference for me. I don't really think that was ever something that was at the forefront of my mind, but it was more.
We'd actually talked about avoiding being too Argento.
Yeah. And so.
I said, I feel the Argento Kellers are more like the bright reds, whereas these Kellers were a little bit darker. So I wasn't trying to say that it was influenced by Argento. It's almost like the opposite.
Right.
Honestly, I think it comes from my interpretation of comic books and the coloring of comics. It comes from the reference of Creepshow in some of the films that I'm a big fan of the 80s in the horror genre and outside of that. But it was also drawn, I think, from the fact that we were creating this Halloween night. To me, color is a part of that. I take my kids to these closed streets that do trick-or-treating, right? And the thing that I always remember is there's always colored lights streaming everywhere in the trees and everything else. So I think it was a mixture of personal experience with my kids and what I've experienced on a street called Maple Street in the town that we actually shot the movie in when we take them trick-or-treating. And then a mix of just the inspiration as Jess and I were talking about, what do we want to see with this film? I personally didn't want to create another dreary monochromatic film, which is super popular right now. And also something where, the blacks were milky. That's another thing that you see a lot on a lot of the Netflix productions. There was no true black in a lot of the films that are coming out now in the genre. So I think it was sort of a reaction for me of getting away from what is so common and trying to do something different, but making sure that we did something different that also served the story. And I think that's where the marriage of these two things worked really well.
One of the things I've spoken with James about too is going into this thing, it's about the cinematography, is I really wanted to steer clear, and he agreed. We both kind of married the idea of steering clear of these polished retro 80s films. So often now you'll see them and they're too polished. They have a light set up here, a blue, a red on either side, and some of it looks fine. But we wanted to stay away from some of the polish. Retro means retro to me. And so what we really wanted to do, we didn't want to build the film off of a look or off of the aesthetic. We wanted the aesthetic to play off of the crazy story we're having. We wanted the characters to be likable. Some of them were caricatures, admittedly so. We had a lot to slot in, but we wanted everyone to be likable and the lighting and the vibe and the feel of the film to be chaotic and to be, what word am I looking for? Intentionally disheveled, like the old films were, like some of those, great ones, like, Night of the Demons were, these films that didn't have perfect lighting. We just wanted the light source. We weren't too worried about the damn motivation, where it was coming from. We just wanted the feel. We wanted the vibe. We wanted you to feel like, and that's one thing I'm most proud of. I think we really accomplished. I feel like our film really does feel like it was made in 1989. And it's not some 2020 that's paying homage and it looks cheap and it looks manufactured. We really did intentionally set out to have it looking a little chaotic. 1988, 1989. We have some color hues. We have different things. We're not trying to be Argento. We just have our own kind of unique look, but we're really paying a real homage, not like some of these polished pieces of shit, you know, that we see now.
Well, and part of it too, I think, was that the imagery that we created, the lighting, the saturation was there. It was motivated to a certain extent by the Halloween aesthetic that was that the production designer Shane did. But we also didn't live and die by that. So if motivation wasn't there, but we wanted to kind of create, a sense of style that especially, you know, what I'm thinking of is the bedroom with Kelly's character, Caroline. There's pink throughout. Well, that really is kind of playing off of her character. And so, yes, was that motivated? No. But does it serve the story? Yes. And so ultimately, with the cinematography, the movement, the lighting, I think it's got to serve the story first and foremost. And to hell with the idea that it has to be motivated by some element in reality. That's how we really charged through with this. And I think it turned out really well. I mean, I'm super stoked and happy with the look of the film in particular.
It's interesting. I was talking to another filmmaker, Vincent DeSanti, a few months ago, who did a Friday the 13th fan film, but a really professionally made one called Never Hike in the Woods or Never Hike Alone in the Woods. And it was fascinating to me. We talked about how there's a lot of films that come out today that want to just ape the 80s slasher movie. And you can't just ape it because culturally it doesn't necessarily make sense to younger people. The culture has sort of changed a lot. You know, I think it's okay to have, you know, a sexy shot in a film as you do in the beginning of the film with the nod to Night of the Demons and the panty shot and whatnot. But there's more going on than just TNA. And I think younger audiences have come to expect that. They're wanting more than just gore and sex. Was that intentional on your part to sort of add more to it than just those elements that a lot of people try to ape from the old exploitation movies?
No question. This, it was very important. Yeah. We, you know, listen, there are caricatures here. There are people that fit slots and, you know, it's a fun movie, but absolutely it's dialogue heavy. The movie is dialogue heavy. I noticed that but absolutely the characters, we do want to like them. They do have some backstory. I would have loved to have paid a lot more attention to the backstory on some of them. We didn't have the time, but without question, this could not be. And I think that's where the charm is in the movie. This is not just a piece that puts tropes together and says, "Here you go. You know, we're going to shovel shit to you, and you can eat it and you can enjoy it." This is these are real. You know, even though there's some comic elements to it, and some not comic elements. And whether they marry or not is up to interpretation or whatever. But this is definitely every person's their own person. And it is not just a meal of tropes served on a dish. It is very important not to just do that. Absolutely.
Do you want to add to that at all, James? I'm curious as to your take on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is a tendency with a lot of films to try to replicate the nostalgia, right? Nostalgia is the big keyword now. But you do have to bring something new to it. And you have to be careful with your audience now because they, I don't want to say that they're more judgmental, but they are more aware and they are looking for more. And whatever the definition of more is, I'm not completely sure, but they do want more depth. And that's actually in some places with Devils where I feel like we took risks and I think it worked, and specifically I'm thinking of Kane's character. That character was someone when Jess, the first scene where he is introduced, when Jess wrote those pages and I first read them, I sat back and I thought, there's no way we can do this. There's no way we can do this scene because we're going to lose our audience. Right. But
it got very dark in that scene, you know,
it does. And I know that there are people that will turn it off at that point, but if you watch for another 15 minutes, suddenly and I'm not going to give it away, the setup that that character had is well served, and the people are going to be cheering that hated him for the first words that came out of his mouth, right? Those are the risks that we took. But to your point, it's about that audience, right? We're not just giving them everything they want up front. We're kind of pissing them off at first, and then ultimately they get what they want for that character. So I think that's the risk, and that was the approach that was taken with how we handled that subplot and that character in particular.
He was a bad guy. We had to make him bad.
And that's it. I mean, there's a common thing now too, where it's like, and I agree with this to a certain extent, where every bad guy's got to have some humanity, right? Because everyone's not bad. I don't know. I don't know that that's necessarily true. I think especially in a film like this, you can have a bad guy that can just be a bad guy. There's not a redeeming quality in Kane's character. And that's okay. And we can dislike him, and we can hate everything that we see him do and say on screen, because that makes, you know, his demise, if it comes about, even that much sweeter.
You know, in that regard, I was going to say, I find it interesting when film is talked about, horror films are seen as being lowbrow oftentimes, you know, oh, it's not Citizen Kane. And I think to myself, I said this to a film teacher of mine once, I said, why does a horror film have to be like Citizen Kane? That's Citizen Kane is sort of a high ambiguity drama. Horror films are melodramas. They mm-hmm. are meant to tackle you with certain emotions. Sometimes they can make you laugh with dark comedy. Sometimes they can creep you out, give you a bit of chills. Sometimes they can just make you go, yuck, ooh. But that's the goal of the horror movie. It's not the same as, you know, some period piece drama about a historical subject.
I could not agree more. One of the mantras that we had during filming was, we're going to live by the sword, or we're going to die by the sword. We are what we are. And we're not going to get away from it. We're not going to feel insecure about it. This is a fun film. It is certainly not trying to be Citizen Kane. We are going in there to give an audience 2 hours, and especially our release got pushed back. We had to deal with a lot of COVID issues, but especially now, especially with people dealing with so much in the world, whether it be the political climate, COVID climate, just intense pressures and stresses. One of the big things that I'm very, very, very happy about that has been a lot of the feedback is the word fun. This is fun. This is fun. I keep hearing it's fun. We set out for one goal. And in our lookbook, when I wrote the lookbook for James, one of the things I wrote in there is I'm setting out to make a film that we can watch twice, three times, four times, and we're going to have a good damn time. We're not going to overthink this first one. I love overthinking things. I love making melodramas and trying to put too much, you know, drama in it. That's fine. But this one, shooting out of the gate, we want to give the audience 2 hours, or an hour and a half rather, where they can pop some popcorn, eat some pizza, and have a good time and forget the bullshit, forget the stress, and laugh or cringe, or say, whoa, that was crazy, or I don't like that, or I love it. But they're going to feel like they got into a little bit of a fight at the end. They're going to know they were there. And once the film closes, it's not going to be like these other films that we watch and we forget the next day. I just want to provide the audience with a good time.
Well, that's the thing. Like, you know, the comparison with Citizen Kane, not every movie can be Citizen Kane, not every movie should be. You know, I'm a huge fan. Citizen Kane's a great movie.
Yeah, but they're different. There's different right. purposes. The goal of right. a Citizen Kane is different than the goal of Night of the Demons or the right. Good Things Devil Just Do.
Yeah, like Shawshank Redemption is another one, a much more modern version that I think is a fantastic film. I watched that film more than I've probably watched most other films, right? But there's also a part of me, and it goes back to part of the conversation we were having earlier. Every movie feels the same now, right? So when I was a kid, you know, I'm 40 now. I was going to the movies, the 90s to me, the late 80s, 90s, that was the prime time for cinema. I would go see a film, whether it was, I don't know, Men in Black or something along those lines. And it was a great time. I was popping popcorn, drinking a soda, transported to a new world, having a good time, laughing, and seeing things I had never seen before, right? And new stories, new concepts that I was being introduced to. And again, I go back to right now, everything we see in cinema, it's probably Marvel. It's probably owned by Disney, right? But it's the same damn story over and over. I'm not a fan of the Marvel films. I'm bored by them now because I think it's the same thing, just rehash and rehash same character. I'm tired of it. I'm tired of the same drama. And that's the thing about Devils. Devils isn't trying to be Shawshank Redemption, right? It's not trying to give you, you don't come out of the movie thinking deep thoughts about, you know, why was Richard such a bad guy? And really, did Percy deserve what he got? Who gives a shit? Did you have fun watching it? Did you enjoy watching, you know, the fight scenes? Did you have a good time? Did you laugh at the appropriate moments or the inappropriate moments? Did you have a good time with the film? And did you experience something that didn't feel like a retread, right? There's nostalgic elements, like you said in the opening of the film. There is the, you know, the homage to Night of the Demons, right? But those are subtle little things that are thrown in there for people that know or fans of those films. But in its whole, as a script, in its visuals, as what we filmed, and every crew member and every contributor to the film brought something unique. I think it's a unique movie that has unique concepts and unique characters that we haven't necessarily seen, right? Compared to all the other movies that are coming out. I stuff that comes on Netflix and stuff that comes in theaters anymore, I don't have fun. I'm bored. I've seen it all.
I don't either.
I was going to add, you mentioned, Jess, that yes, the characters are caricatures. That's actually what I like about it, though, that some of the characters are caricatures, or that they are cartoonish. Because when I'm reading, say, an EC Comics book, like, you know, Tales from the Crypt, or, you know, Tales of Mystery and Suspense, whatever, Two-Fisted Tales, you know, the reason they work is because they're not cerebral. They're not trying to get you to think about whether the character is good or bad. They're just tales that sort of gut punch you, or they make you laugh when the bad guy gets beat up, or, you know, they make you sad at some points. And that's what I think really works with this movie, is you got a, you know, just fistful of emotions all over the place.
I agree, man. This is a comic book. This is a, like when I went to Suttles earlier, I said, listen, we're going to paint this out like Creepshow, like Night of the Demons. This is a comic book. So some of these characters are going to be comic book characters, and some of them aren't. And that's kind of where some of it works. And I've heard reviews that some said, hey, it didn't work for them. And I get that. And that's understandable. They intersect. It's not going to work for everybody. But yeah, I mean, absolutely. Like you said, this is like a comic book. You have Melvin, Caroline, and Louise, and they're these, you know, bumbling couple, and he's wanting to start this museum of the macabre. He's a retired professor, and all these Halloween-y kids are, you know, they go over to his house and he's bitching about he can't, you know, get masquerade over there. You know, his primary goal in the entire film, his objective and Richard's objective are both very different. Melvin's is to open the museum, and he's got to masquerade as his showpiece, and not to give anything away, but that we come back to that. You know, we'll return in to that little angle, whether Melvin can make sure that remains a showpiece or not. Richard's is to get the money and get out. It's a little oblique as to whether he gets the right house or not. And so these two objectives intersect. And of course, masquerade's like, well, hell with both of them. My objective is to kill you all. And so yeah, it's a little comic booky and a little pulpish. They're all going for what they're going for, and then let the chips fall where they may.
You know, I want to get into the cast, because everyone has been talking about it. You did a real good job with the cast. But first, I also wanted to add, I think that some of the criticisms I've seen of the movie really boil down to this idea of quote-unquote tonal shifts. Right. You know, Oh, at one second it's funny, and then in the next scene something happens that is like really sort of upsetting or sad or... And to me, that's what makes it great. It's like a roller coaster ride. I mean, was that the intent, or was that a happy accident, the roller coaster ride aspect?
You can, James will tell you as much as that was definitely the intention. And again, it's that, you know, we poured all those ingredients there, and it works for some, it doesn't for some. Some really liked it, but the tonal shifts bothered them. Some loved the tonal shifts, but it was definitely a part of it. I whether I was successful or not, you know, it was a... I loved incorporating this intense melodrama with him trying to save his daughter with something funny that happens, like Melvin, you know, putting a bowl on top of the kid or something, you know, and possessions and body mutilation mixed with, you know, we're going to be okay. And I'm glad to have you back, daughter, and welcome back, Mouse.
I love the bit with the Alexa And it says, playing best or worst stepdaughter song ever.
I'm glad you liked that. I wasn't sure that would work, but I'm glad you liked that. We did it. We shot it. We said, hell with it. Let's do it. We said, well, let's do it.
Well, I think one of the things too, like talking about what criticism there has been about the tonal shift, I think the way I've looked at it is that that's become sort of the projection of expectations, right? So, people are looking at horror films, they walk into it with certain expectations. If you don't deliver those expectations, then they feel like, oh, maybe it didn't quite hit what I was expecting. So is that a criticism of the film not working? Or is that a criticism of just not delivering what you thought? And to your, you know, to your analogy, it's a roller coaster. Every movie should be a roller coaster, right? Why are we creating roller coasters that are exactly the same everywhere? Otherwise, the third ride you go on, you're going to be bored, right? It's like vanilla ice cream. Sometimes you want strawberry and blueberries. Sometimes you want Kit Kats and caramel, right? You gotta mix it up some. And that's what makes this movie unique and fun. It mixes it up. It throws it in, like Jess said, one moment you're pissed off and yelling at the screen. The next moment you're laughing and you're not sure what you saw. You know, so that was the goal. That's what we went for. If it didn't work for everybody, that's okay. But it's worked for the vast majority of people, I think.
What's interesting to me in that tonal shift sort of criticism, not to stick on it too much, but, you know, if you look at the established classics of theater or film, a lot of those, you know, even Shakespeare would be a good example, where you read Shakespeare and tragedy will strike, and then the next scene is comedy relief. You know, I think those tonal shifts are necessary in a way.
I do too. And you know, and I don't mind sticking on it because a lot of people have said it, but I've read two or three reviews and were particularly, they were saying, hey, you know, he was trying to make Kane Hodder a funny guy and it didn't work. I was not trying to make Kane Hodder funny. His lines were not funny. He was not a funny character. He was not part of the comedy. He was to help me think of a good analogy, something I'm a little been going at it all day today. My brain's rotten, but he was basically the sword coming in through, basically busting through. He was the bull in the china shop, for fuck's sake. Excuse my friend, my language. But we were having this funny thing, and no, he wasn't funny. He was interjecting himself into this cute little story and being awful. And they had to contend with him. The vampire had to contend with him. The people, his own team, had to contend with him. He was not funny. He was not meant to be funny. His lines were not funny. He was this bad guy who is just stuck out of place in this cutesy movie who is fucking things up. And so was Masquerade. And they weren't trying to be funny. This was not a funny thing. So it's interesting that you say that because, some people associated that with being a part of the tonal shift. Hey, why is he trying to be funny? Why are they trying to make that? He wasn't. This was for better or for worse, the two kinds of ideas clashing together and you know, what happens.
I was going to add to that. I think there's even a few moments that are, I don't want to say tear jerking, but you know, they either make you sad or, you know, they hit you in the feels a little bit. I'm specifically thinking about the sort of relationship between Melvin and Linnea Quigley's character, Wheezy, and also the dysfunctional stepdaughter. There's some moments between their interactions that actually make you go, aw, or, you know, you're sad that one character mistreated another. It's not just, you know, these characters running around and you don't feel anything for them.
They should, absolutely. I'm very glad for that. Had I been able to add more backstory and had we been able, I would have loved to. All the characters had a lot more backstory than we were able to afford to put in the film. But we really wanted to do that. And James can, you know, we spoke a lot about this is this movie was chock full of stuff. It was definitely not boring. There's almost not a dull moment in it. And that's something I'm proud of. But to do that, for better or for worse, we had to cut a lot out. We had, James, what, help me out here. I mean, we were cutting and adding per day. The script was taking different forms per day. I mean, really, it was pretty amazing. So we just wanted to make sure that we kept some humanity, even though they were caricatures, even though they were cartoony, they did need some humanity. And the things that were happening to them isn't funny. The things that were happening to them were horrible, and they were sad, and therefore the characters reacted as such.
James, do you want to add anything to that? Is there anything that you guys added or, you know, had to take out that really stuck out to you?
Well, I think that there's a lot of reasons why things were taken and added. And I think that, I guess what I can really add to this is that I think that the humanity that was there was just hints of humanity that was left in Linnea's character and in Melvin and all of them. There's little hints of humanity there because they help the audience identify, right? And so one thing that's different than if you're reading a book or a comic book or something along those lines is you're able to kind of inject your own humanity into it. You can identify with those characters. You're reading them on the page. You're imagining them, right? And so even with a popcorn film like this, it is necessary for there to be just an ounce of humanity that you can identify with so that they do feel human. Because if you really think about it, you know, the three, Melvin and Louise, and Caroline, they are our human characters. They are the ones that we can attach to and identify with the most. Richard and his daughter, they're the ones invading the space. They feel antagonistic from the beginning. Even though you develop a relationship with them and you start to see their humanity, there's still a dark side to them that you can't quite 100% identify with, I think. Mm-hmm. And so I think what was smart about leaving just the touch of humanity that's there with the characters was the fact that it allows you to identify. But we couldn't leave too much, because if we left too much, then it becomes a drama, becomes a talking headpiece, and we lose that pacing that we have in the film. Because the one thing that the film doesn't do, like Jess said, is it doesn't stop. It takes a breath, but then it picks right back up, right? And so, you know, the 82 minutes that the film is, it speeds by because you're on this wild roller coaster. It was necessary to tell the story the way we did, I think. And so we had to remove things from it so that we didn't break what was an intentional pacing for the film.
Now, I said I wanted to get into the cast. We've been building up this. One of the things that this movie is sort of well known for at this point is you got Bill Oberst Jr., who's really sort of become, you know, the ultimate heavy character actor, especially for a new generation of people. He reminds me of like a Michael Ironside or a Lance Henriksen, really great actor. And then you also have a legendary scream queen, Linnea Quigley, and of course, Jason himself. Kane Hodder. How did these three become involved? And Jess, if you could, what's interesting is you mentioned the day player thing, which is, of course, when you have an actor come in for a day of shooting and they're in it for 5 seconds or 2 minutes or 5 minutes, and then they're out of the film. And every movie that comes out straight to DVD that has one of these horror actors in it, a lot of them do that. And you feel ripped off afterwards. Whereas with this movie, all the characters feel pretty substantial, even Kane, who is sort of in a guest starring role.
I'll try to make this brief as possible so James can come in here, but too, because James is my producer and he was the one reaching out to all these guys. But I banged the table. I told James, I want Linnea Quigley. It's important to remember I'm a fan. I'm a horror fan. I grew up on horror. I loved horror all my life, and I wanted to make a movie for the fans who are sick and tired of the same old shit. So I said, all right, I'm going to give them something. I'm going to give them a ride. I'm going to give them the kind of ride I want to see. So fans, brace yourselves. We're going to get back to what we do good here. And Linnea Quigley was the first order of business. Bill Oberst was the guy who was the lead or one of the co-leads, co-stars in the film, but was really the star. And I was worried that, again, there were budgetary constraints. We were working under a lot of restrictions, but we wanted to really rebel against the day player mode. So Kane Hodder was brought in when James came and told me, he said, listen, we got a chance at Kane. It's going to be a challenge, but we got a chance at Kane. I said, fuck it. We're going to get Kane. We have to get Kane. Kane and Lay were my own players from, you know, that I had sworn when I was younger, I'm going to work with these guys. I got a few more. I'm going to get them on the next one. And so Kane was brought in. Who better to pass the torch to Masquerade as the main heel, as the main villain? But I did not want to bring Kane in as a day player. So we really gave him more. I mean, he was apprehensive about it at first, but I think he loves it now. Kane is tremendous. He's a great actor, just a wonderful pro. All of them are, Linnea, Bill, even all the supporting role players, so good. But that's really the genesis of that. It was Linnea. We found out we could get Kane. We worked very hard. We got Kane. Bill Oberst was in the he was in play because of his previous relationship with James. James had basically said, we got a chance at getting this guy for our star. I said, please, James, make it happen. And he did. And he did.
Well, I think the thing with, so from my perspective, yeah, it's exactly what Jess is saying, but like from, I think the first pitch of this script, it was Linnea, you know, Linnea was playing this. And at first our budget was smaller, you know, we were trying to do it for a little less money. And so we're like, okay, we'll get Linnea. And, you know, I reached out to her management and we were able to pull her together pretty quick. It was pretty simple getting Linnea involved. But then we were still sitting here licking strip and we're doing local auditions. And when you're working on a budget like we do, travel is expensive, right? So you try to cast as much as you can locally. But the problem with the script was that Richard's character, it had to be someone that would deliver. And it was about performance. It wasn't about Bill Oberst as a name, per se. It was about finding an actor that could actually pull it off and carry the film.
Absolutely.
And so I think, I remember we were sitting at the conference room, I think, Jess, and I was like, you know, what about Bill? And Bill did a movie with me, I guess it was 13 years ago now. It was actually the first feature I directed. And Bill came in to audition, and this is before he was known in the horror circle. I don't even think he had done a horror film at this point. I think he was doing mostly like costume drama and that kind of thing. He's a fantastic actor. But Bill since then has become the Bill Oberst Jr. that we all know. And so when I pitched that to Jess, it was like a eureka moment. It was like, yeah, definitely. And so we made that happen. And then Kane was just, it was actually through the management with Linnea's management where his name came up and it's like, we could potentially make this work. And I was trying to do the producer thing and figure out how financially to make it happen. But as soon as Kane's name came up, I mean, it was Jess. I mean, you were like, absolutely, we have to do it. And it took a little more than just a yes. It took a little bit of pushing and pulling on the budget and making sure that we could afford it. But that was, but back to the whole day player thing, that was another conversation that we had because originally the Percy role was a little smaller. Really kind of a day player. We were just going to get a local day player. Mm-hmm. And then when Kane came up, part of the conversation was expanding. And that's actually where the intro scene got developed and expanded.
Yep. You wrote that right before we kicked off.
Yeah. And like you said, I Kane was hesitant because there's a lot of dialogue. I mean, his scene, it's for those that haven't seen the movie, it's one single shot. I think the shot's 3 minutes, I think. And it's all him. It's performance. And it's not him just behind a mask. It's him actually being an asshole to a couple of people and carrying dialogue through the whole thing. And like you said, Jess, he's a great actor. People don't see it because he's been sort of relegated behind this mask. And that's his facade that he's created and the character, I guess, that goes along with him. But man, people need to really give Kane another look because Kane delivered something that made his character work in this movie purely off of performance.
And it's getting noticed and I'm happy about that.
Yeah.
How long did you have Kane on set for? Because like I said, it really does feel like a substantial role, even if he's only in it for what, maybe 10, 15 minutes, it actually feels substantial. Whereas most of these movies feel like they're just doing a cash in cameo.
He's a critical component. James, remind me, did we have him on for 3 days?
Technically he was on for 5, but we actually only used him for 4.
Okay.
And part of the challenge of getting Kane in is that there was literally 1 week in our production that he was available. He was doing a show, I think, in Atlanta. And then he had another show that he was doing in Detroit, I think. And we were like this nice little window of 6 days that he could come in and, you know, work with us.
But we lost Bill.
What's that?
But we lost Bill. We lost Bill for a considerable amount of time. So we really had to be pretty clever.
Because Bill Oberst, he had to leave. And it was actually that same week he had to go out of town for another commitment. So there was a little bit of script rewriting and adjustment and working with Matt Zabiowski, who AD'd, making sure that the schedule could kind of fit. And it's like Lego pieces when you're putting these schedules together, right? And so Bill left, Kane came in, we shot his bit. In fact, here's a little bit of film trivia for you. There's in the Halloween trick-or-treating scene where the three antagonists get out of the car and they're walking through the streets. Bill's character is wearing a mask at that point. Bill wasn't there. That's a stand-in. So that scene, that iconic shot in the movie where it's the three of them, Kane and Mouse and Richard are walking together. Bill wasn't there. That's somebody else. And that's purely because of scheduling.
I was going to ask in that regard, what were the biggest challenges in filming? And then maybe we could talk very briefly about post-production struggles.
James, you certainly, I would, whatever you say may be different than mine. For mine, financial time. Like I said, we shot this in 12 days. We initially wanted 16. I think we got 12.
No, we got 15. We had 15.
We had 15?
We had 15 days, but we did cut about a day out.
So. We did. I know we lost a day. So maybe we had 14. Either way, time and money, you know, this would be what every director would probably saying to you, time and money. Had we only had more time and we only had more money, we had a lot of investors come on. The pressure was on to make something fun, but to make something that would turn around and sell. I think the investors are happy right now. The movie is getting some pretty good ratings. The people reviewing it are liking it, most of them anyway. So we had a lot of investors come on. We got to make sure the pressure's on to deliver. So we wish we had more time and money, but we didn't. Those were that for me. The difficulties for me is I just wish we had more to budget for the effects, actors being, actor availability, and shooting days. What about you, James?
Overall, it sounds not to interrupt you, but overall, it sounds like maybe the shoot itself went by pretty well, based on what you're saying there. But the monetary constraints and the time constraints may have been stressful.
Well, yeah, we part of making a film at this budget level is that you have to, every penny counts, right? So you can't throw money at a problem. And we had a few problems pop up, and we didn't have money, so we had to use other resources to figure those out. But most of it was tied to schedule. How much can you get done in 15 days of production? I also have this weird thing where I've been in this business for so long, I can't stand working 12-hour days. And that's sort of, in a movie like this, usually you would hear people go 14, 15-hour days, and the crew's got to put it in for the sake of the art and for the sake of the project. And that's just not the reality. The guys that I work with that worked on this film, we all have families. We all want to go home. So we try to keep it as close to 10-hour days as we can. I mean, this movie, we pushed it up against 12 a few days. But those are self-imposed restrictions, I guess. But they're important ones, because part of making a movie at this budget, too, is that you can't pay the crew what they're worth. And so, therefore, you're asking them to do more for less for longer if you go long days. And so the whole goal for me on anything that I'm producing is to keep our days as short as possible, make back the next day and the subsequent days, and deliver more and better for you, right? So I guess the challenge is trying to stick to those promises that you've made and those commitments that you've kind of made to yourself to deliver on that type of stuff.
And James, I have to go ahead and I have to say this also, what you're saying is so critical here. It's very important, because this type of film too, not being a drama, not being just, your regular shot, this was cold, it was freezing. And if you ever talk to the actors, they'll tell you they were wet, they were saturated in blood, they were saturated in fluids, they were freezing their asses off. They were in small Halloween costumes. The crew were building sets day for nights, extravagant Halloween setup, a lot of different shots, dolly shots, Steadicam. It was very important to not go over, because otherwise we're getting into the 10th day, the 12th day, and everyone's going to be pissy and tired and not be able to do it. And the actors are going to be tapped out. But in a horror movie like this, I think it's more demanding on them physically, emotionally. There's a lot of screaming. There's a lot of joy. There's a lot of sadness. And this is a taxing, taxing film. So we did have to really make sure that our days stuck to 10 or 12 hours, lest we lose control.
Well, and that's something too that is worth mentioning, is that we had some comfort, some health considerations too. It was cold. I mean, it was middle of February when we're shooting. We were shooting in the mountains of North Carolina, so it gets chilly. And Veronica, who plays Masquerade, there's a sequence where we had to have her buried. We literally dug a hole, had her body down in this hole, and then we had a fake body torso on top of her. And her body temperature got dangerously low. And we had to pull her out real quick and get her inside. Like, we had some things like that. Some, you know, there's things that you got to be really careful of and take care of your cast and crew.
That's right.
And on a small film like this, it's so easy. And I've been on those productions where that sort of gets thrown to the side. And we can't do that. You can't treat people that way. So we pulled her up out of the hole. And we sent her inside and we got her body temperature back up, and she was a hell of a trooper. Because she went back down in it and went back to work as soon as she was, you know, to the point where she wasn't going to pass out. So, I mean, there's always war stories with films, and there's always drama that happens. But with a film like this, money isn't your cure. So you just got to make sure you get the right team that know how to creatively fix any problems that come up. And you got to trust the team to do their job. And that's the thing that is even 10 times more important on a film this size, is you have to trust your team. And I think we had a great team. I think we had a great cast. And we all knew the restrictions going into it. So, you know, I think the shoot went pretty well considering what limited limitations we had.
Did you have to time crunch when it came to the child actors?
Yeah. I mean, what we did there is we split their days. And so for example, the teenage girl that is almost decapitated, that her throat gets ripped open by Masquerade, was actually my daughter Piper. And so there we brought her in. I think we shot the front half of the scene the first night of the shoot, if I remember right, Jess. And then we came back and shot the second half of the scene maybe 3 or 4 nights later. It might have been a week later, if I remember right. So there was some concern there. We had to make sure that we were splitting them up where we weren't keeping them more than 3 or 4 hours, that kind of thing. So that, again, is those Lego blocks that is schedule building and is so difficult.
Right. Maddox, we were lucky that Maddox Robertson, the kid who played Danny, he was the son of Kelly. Who played Caroline. And so we were lucky to be where they were getting to be there. And when he had to cut, he was still able to chill out and grab some coffees and donuts and chill out with his mom. But again, we talk about those long hours. I mean, Kelly was playing in the film in a mini skirt, and Maddox was in this very thin Halloween costume in the cold. There was a lot of time crunching there for sure. But we pulled it off, man.
I just wanted to ask two more things, and then I promise to let you guys go if you have time. The first thing I wanted to ask about was, you know, I think a lot of people look at film as almost, you know, oh, the director is like the dictator. You know, he sort of decides everything, and it's simply his vision. But it sounds like from past interviews I've heard that, you know, you allowed an actor like Bill Oberst to sort of add his spin to the character that may not have initially been intended. And I wanted to get your thoughts on the collaborative nature of film and Bill's sort of spin on the Richard character.
Well, and in my opinion, you have to. Any good director is going to let the actor at least have input and put their own spin on, and especially when you get a seasoned pro like him. I'll make the story quick, but Richard was initially a radically different character. And Bill and I spoke about this, and he had his visions for this character. And I wasn't sold initially. I said, can you give me a night? Can I think about it? The answer is a soft no, but I'll think about it, Bill. I'm going to give you the respect. Well, I thought about it. James and I had this conversation, and we were so happy that Bill was wanting to put his own spin on it. But I was like, you know, this is great, but I just am not sure it worked. Well, when I woke up in the morning, I had a eureka moment. So I called him and I said, how about we do this? How about we compromise and we do this? And Bill said, I'm telling you that I'm so happy you said that, because if you allow me to take this from my direct, Bill's a pro. He's going to do whatever the hell you need him to do. He's a pro's pro. But he said, I'm so excited about playing it this way that I think you'll see a difference. I said, man, that's all I need. That's all I need. And it worked. It worked. And, I think any good director better let the actor have some input. If I don't want to be, listen, I got my vision and there's certain ways we're going to do things. And I'm not, you know, the set's going to run. It's a dictator, it's not a dictatorship, but it's a well-oiled machine. You know, we don't have everyone running up and offering their ideas. That's not how it works. But when James comes to me and says, well, why don't we do something with this lighting setup? I have an idea. I'm going to be an idiot if I don't consider that. And And I loved a lot of their ideas. Some I said no, some I said, hell yeah, let's do it. Same thing with the actors. Hey, what I got to spin right here? Or they'll read a little off script, or they'll start improvising and it's magic. Sometimes it doesn't work. We had a lot of them improvisation there that was just didn't work and we didn't use it. Some of it was fantastic. Bill had a line. It's your mail order vampire. The mail order vampire. I loved it. Was indeed a mail order vampire. That was not in the script. That was all Bill.
And the last thing I wanted to ask about was, of course, you have Linnea Quigley in it. And I was thinking, oh, Linnea's not going to be in it after this point. And then it turns out that she's still in it. And I was thinking, they didn't get a body double. You know, did they put her in all that makeup? Was that?
Yep. We sure did.
I'm curious then, because that leads into what was the makeup effects like? Because I know when I had Linnea on, and I'll be releasing that interview after this one, she said that on Night of the Demons, going through the makeup was hellish. I assume this may have been a little bit better for her.
It was. We didn't have nearly the kind of prosthetics that she had to get into. She didn't turn into, you know, she was able just to be herself and have whatever transition. Well, you know, she's on the cover. She, you know, when she turns, she's still Linnea Quigley. She just has a little bit, she's a little gored up and she's obviously very bloody and it's got some teeth and things like that. But with Night of the Demons, she had to have a chest piece. There were, you know, she's ripping into her body. Her face, she had to have, you know, molds built for her face. We didn't need all that. We just didn't need it. She was still freezing her ass off. It was still very uncomfortable for Linnea, and it was still very unpleasant for her on some parts. But I don't think it was nearly the rigorous stretch she had to endure with Night of the Demons.
Did the makeup effects, like, how long would they take, and how do they gel with your shooting? Was there ever times where they would conflict?
Oh, hell yeah. But that's the nature of the game. A lot of times we'd run down there, let's get it. More blood, more blood, more blood. No, we need more blood. No, we need this. No, we need that. But the FX team, John Lauterbach, Faith, what is her last name?
James Faith Tramp.
Faith Tramp, they were amazing. I mean, they responded and they were pulling a lot of weight here. And I was not pleasant. I would run down there, we need more now. And boy, I'm telling you, they worked so well under pressure. They're phenomenal. They're stars in my book. Yeah, I mean, it was constant clashing with the time schedules. But that's, James, would you say that's the nature of the game, especially in something like this? Wouldn't you say?
Well, I mean, when you go into producing something at this scale, I mean, you have to keep all of that in mind. So part of John and Faith's job is making sure that we're not being too aggressive or too hopeful of what we can accomplish in a given day. And that means you have to keep in mind what is the schedule of that day. So fun little trivia here. Everything that takes place in the bedroom with Linnea on the bed, and it's a substantial amount of the film, was shot in one day. Linnea's schedule was tight too. We had her on for 5 days, if I remember right. And the last day that we had her was the day that we did everything with her on the bed. That was also the day that we did the makeup effects. So we had to make sure that what effects we did for that scene could be accomplished within, I think it was about an hour and 15, hour and 30 minutes, because we shot everything with Linnea on the bed laying there prior to her transition. And then we sent her downstairs to get into makeup for that hour, hour and a half. Meanwhile, we were covering all of the turnarounds on Kelly and on Melvin. That allowed us, so again, the Lego boxes, blocks of the schedule, right? So then we got the turnarounds, and then by the time we got done with the coverage on Kelly, then it was time for Linnea to come back up. She was in full makeup effect, and we were able to get those shots that we needed with her.
And James, those shots were Linnea and Kelly, the mother-daughter scenes, which were emotionally taxing in some parts and a physical in some parts. There was an escape attempt and different things. That was a hell of a day.
Yeah, if I remember right, I think it was 9 pages of the script that we shot on that day with Linnea. We could not fail because she was flying out the next day. Mm-hmm. That was one of the more challenging days, even though it was all in one room, all with pretty much one lighting setup with some minor tweakage here and there. The makeup effects were pretty heavy. We ended up shooting it mostly, I think most of that shot on gimbal, actually. And to be honest, that was out of necessity. We couldn't do standard coverage on that day because with 9 pages, we would probably have been attempting to do 40-something setups. And 40 setups for filmmakers, 40 setups is insane. You know, I try to max out around 25, 26 setups in a day. So to be honest, some of the aesthetics with camera work on those scenes in that bedroom were determined by the fact that we were restricted on our schedule of when we were losing Linnea and we had to shoot it out in one day.
That's why we had to fall back and do so many gimbal shots. And we had a lot of changes made on that day too. We were
busy. Yeah. And not to say that that should ever be a crutch that people fall back on, but when you're dealing with film, it doesn't matter what budget level, you're always going to have scheduling restrictions and technical restrictions. And, you know, I think the proof is in the pudding of how we were able to take our limitations, i.e. the camera movement, and make that work for that scene. So everything that takes place in that bedroom has a certain aesthetic style to the movement. So it doesn't feel like a Band-Aid that we were using to fix a production issue. It was something that we were able to kind of create a nice, cinematic approach to.
We didn't allow it to be a crutch. Once we realized what we were up against, and once we made the changes, part of those changes, James, I recall you and I talking about, is the camera work, the gimbal work, and the aesthetic that we were going to make with these scenes. And so we just literally altered our approach and we made it work, and we did it with intention.
Yeah.
Last question here. How did you pull off the sort of special effects, like the levitating, on such a small scale budget?
Which scene in particular?
I thought there was a scene or two where, Bill Oberst levitated for a second when Master Melvin. Uses telekinesis. Melvin, yes.
And when she pushes the chairs. That was just a great crew, man.
That's such a simple...
James, don't give it away.
No, I'm going to give it away.
Ruin it. We're going to ruin it.
It's a ladder with a piece of speed rail, so a bar, and he's doing a pull-up.
He sure is.
It literally is a chair, two ladders and a pole, and he's doing a pull-up, and then it's just creative editing.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes the stuff that makes the biggest impact is like the simplest.
Right. You know, I mean, and strings tied onto the chairs when a masquerade pushes everything out of the way when she's getting ready to rock and roll.
That's monofilament. When those chairs pull away, there's no visual effects there at all. That's monofilament, or i.e. fishing line tied to the leg. That's it.
We one of our things too is I told James, hey, we're going practical, man. We're not doing the CGI shit. We're going practical with it.
Right. I mean, and that's something, that's one thing that Jess and I agreed on at the very beginning was, practical is better. I'm so tired of CGI. I'm so tired of space battles. I would so much rather there be, the Battlestar Galactica or the old school Star Wars. Because no matter what, when you had something tactile that was filmed by a camera, it looks better. It just does. And that was the approach here. I mean, we have some VFX shots in the movie, knife extensions. There's a bat scene where the bat's used as a stake. That was some VFX extensions, but we using VFX on a limited scale to me makes a better film. The more practical you are, the more real it is. And I think that sometimes comes from my opinion of that comes from the cinematographer. I hate the idea of shooting green screen. The day that film goes to stages where you're shooting, 360 degree green screen, i.e. Something similar to say Mandalorian, for example. I mean, that's great and that's fancy technology, but man, I'll be retired sitting on my porch, rocking in my chair, drinking my iced tea before I do that shit.
I also feel like CGI and too many of those computer effects can be a crutch too.
Yeah, totally.
Well, I really loved the use of practical effects. I loved a great deal of this movie. I really enjoyed it. I want to thank both of you for coming on Parallax Views and helping us celebrate the Halloween season with the good things devils do. If you could, how can my listeners get a hold of the good things devil do? Physical copy, streaming, where can they get those things? And also, what would your pitch be to anyone that may not be like a super horror movie fanatic, but may want to see the film? How would you pitch it to them?
James, why don't you tell them where they can get it?
Yeah. So, Blu-ray, DVD, you can get it on Amazon, Best Buy, Target. I mean, Family Video, pretty much any of the retailers out there that you can order physical copies. And as far as streaming, Apple, iTunes, you got it on Amazon for rental. You've got it, Xbox, Microsoft Store, PlayStation, satellite cable. Pretty much our distributors did a fantastic job of getting it out there in all the venues. So just do a search. You'll find it. If it's a service you have, it's probably there.
If it's sold out, it's sold out in some areas. Simply keep moving. There are some areas that are sold out, but they get them back. If you're looking for a physical copy, keep looking, and they're coming in. As far as a pitch to those who are not horror fans or maybe casual horror fans, I'm going to use the one word that seems to be used over and over and over again. It's fun. It's in the season of it's in Halloween season, but even if it's not, even if we're into November, December, the summer, whatever, it's a movie that when you sit back, you're going to watch it. It goes by fast. James said it plays fast. I agree with him 100%. We set out, and the one thing that we did do, I can tell you with 100% certainty we were successful, is we made a fast-moving, entertaining, hell no, we're not boring film. If you want to be entertained, if you want to find something a little different, if you want to find something that has a unique factor to it, the quintessential uniqueness, as a friend of mine once said, Devils is it. The good things Devils do does bring that. You're going to have a good time. You may not like it as much as someone else does. I've recently seen some people on Twitter saying, hey, this is my new favorite film. I love hearing that. It may not be your favorite film. It may be your favorite film. But we're different than the standard fare that you've been seeing. We're better than a lot of the streamers that are out there. We're freaking entertaining. We're going to entertain you. Let me just say that. We are going to entertain you for better or for worse. We're going to take your ass on a ride. You're punching the ticket. You're going to go for a ride. You may be pissed off when you get out and say that drop was too steep or whatnot. You may love it, but we're going to take you for a ride. You will be entertained.
Well, I think that's the perfect note to end on. Thank you again, James and Jess, for coming on Parallax Views and introducing my listeners to the good things Devils do. I hope it becomes part of their annual Halloween viewing.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Well, that does it for the first edition of the Parallax Views Halloween Podcast Massacre. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jess Norvisgaard and James Suttles of the fun and exciting new vampire romp, The Good Things Devils Do. Check it out on streaming services if you can. It is a great popcorn flick to watch on and around the Halloween season. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Amelia, Mark, Martin, Brace, John, Ted, Zach, Gratz, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well then, consider supporting me on Patreon at the $10 or $15 tier at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,